What I'm going to do to start off is give just a review of what we covered yesterday as an introduction and lead in today, especially for those who might not have been here yesterday. But to my right here, a quick introduction again, Mr. Glenn White, who's been part of the church for over 43 years and in the ministry for 36 years. And you heard a little bit from Glenn yesterday about his experience with alcohol. And so it's been a passion in his life to help others who struggle with alcohol. And Myrna Leisure, who has been a member of the church for 40 years, has grown up in the church. Some of you will relate to that. Most of her life then in the church. Was a member of the United Church of God in Eagle Rock, California, Southern California, and has devoted her life to service in this field as well, has been recognized by the National Council on Alcoholism for her service in the community, runs her own sober living facilities for men and women, has been a counselor to men and women in the alcohol situation. You're going to be hearing a little more from Myrna this morning about her personal story. And then my experience, 40 years in the church, 37 in the ministry, and growing up in an alcoholic family. So we have different perspectives here in our lives. And so in the last 20 years or so, I've been very involved in the area of alcoholism and counseling and helping people, both the alcoholic and the families of alcoholics. Now, what we covered yesterday is why this subject is important. I gave a handout to you on alcoholism and alcohol-related problems. And some of the facts may have been pretty astounding. How many of you, I hope you all, who didn't get a copy of the handout? Everybody got one? Okay. Thanks, Myrna. If you want to run that back. Anyone else? I do have a few extra copies, but this would be something for you to hold on to. This is from the webpage of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Addiction. And it'll help you to understand the magnitude of the problem with alcohol. Incredible impact that alcohol has upon our society, upon families, upon individual lives. It's actually a horrendous problem. It's a very serious problem, not only in America, but in the world. And that's what we talked about yesterday. In some countries, like Russia, two-thirds of the men are dying of alcoholism, and that's a fact. They did a three-year study. It's a scary statistic. And there, of course, the nation is having serious problems. So we looked at why this subject is important from that point of view. And then I mentioned as well that it's not just a problem in the society, outside in the world, quote unquote. We also have a problem with it in the church. The Bible addresses it. The Bible talks about it. But if most of you have probably been in the church for quite a few years, you're aware of that. And I talked a little bit about that. Through lack of education, through ignorance, people become addicted to alcohol, become either abusers of alcohol. They may not necessarily be alcoholic. As we saw yesterday, an alcoholic is someone who has become addicted to the drug alcohol. And they need it. Their cells have adapted that need, and we'll talk more about that today in a lot more detail, and you're going to see a film that I think will help you as well. And then I went through what God says about alcohol abuse in the Bible. If you'll remember, we looked at, and there are a lot of scriptures and examples of even some of God's servants who drank and got drunk. And whenever they did, you usually see sexual sin was involved. How not to use alcohol. And then we looked at the positive uses, God's intended use for alcohol, that God did create alcohol to be a blessing for man, that it's to make the heart merry. Alcohol used in small quantities is a stimulant and relaxes a person and enables them, it says, wine was made for a feast and to make the heart merry. So we looked at the positive uses that way, like at the Passover, the sacrament uses of the wine, and there are other uses like that. We saw that wine also actually is a food when used in moderation, like beer and some of these natural fermented alcoholic beverages are actually medicinal. They're a food. They provide calories and certainly even vitamins and minerals and nutrients. So we reviewed these positive blessings of alcohol that God intended. So why has alcohol become such a curse? And why does approximately 10% of the population, 90% of the population can drink alcohol, their liver, their body metabolizes it, that is, breaks it down into its various chemicals, and it provides energy to the body. But about 10% of the population, that doesn't work. Because, as we're going to see a little bit more today, then I'd like to review for you a little bit more on that and just my review here. And this is the area that is somewhat controversial in people's minds, and that is, it's called the disease concept of alcoholism. And that is through research. And I'm going to recommend one book to you, if you've got any book on the subject, the one that's been the most helpful to me, that explains it in easy-to-understand terms, that gives the research that has gone on, that will help you to understand why an alcoholic becomes addicted to the drug alcohol and begins to have serious problems with it. Whereas someone else may drink too much, they'd be a drunkard, but they can stop. It's called Under the Influence. Maybe you've heard of it. But Under the Influence, A Guide to the Myths and Realities of Alcoholism. And it is in paperback. It's not expensive. But it's an excellent book that gives the facts and all the research that has gone on. I don't say all, but it gives much research and will prove to you, I believe, that there is a difference in the bodies, that something has happened to the liver, that there's been a degeneracy. Now, you think about it. When God created wine, vineyards and grapes and the fermentation process and the wine, he intended it to be a blessing for man. But through abuse over the generations, through sin, it has become a curse to many people. In other words, man sins by abusing the things that God has given us to be blessings. And it's Satan who is behind it all, but turns God's blessings into a curse for some people, don't they? What it was intended to be a blessing becomes a curse for some. But it'll give you the scientific facts and research, and it's not a cop-out, it's not an excuse. What it is, it gives the understanding necessary to treat alcoholics and save them from death. Because they will die if somebody doesn't intervene in their lives. They will die of the alcohol. Just a little bit. I'll just read a little bit to you, because I only want to take a few more minutes on this, but it will explain why some people cannot metabolize alcohol. It talks about their metabolism. It goes into the individual chemistry of each person's body. We are all unique. They're discovering that. Each of our bodies are unique. That's why some of you can eat certain foods, some of you can't. Some of you can handle sugar, and some of you can't. Each person's body chemistry is unique. And alcohol is a complicated substance that works differently in each individual, depending upon their body chemistry. And it is the liver, and we're going to see this, some of these astounding facts in the movie today. The liver is the main organ of the body involved in the metabolism of alcohol. And if you have a liver that doesn't work right, and many people do, they do not properly metabolize or break down that alcohol, and it becomes a poison to them. It becomes a drug as powerful as opium. And they'll become addicted to it. And they're not even aware of this happening. And again, I want to emphasize to you that this knowledge that is coming out enables the medical profession to save the lives of many of these people. And that's why it's so important. It is not a cop-out, because an alcoholic is responsible, once he has this knowledge and understanding of that he is a sick person and he's become a drug addict, he is responsible to take the proper action, to get help, to deal with that. So it's very important for you to understand that. And this book also will give you convincing evidence that has been done on the children of alcoholics and this, what is going on there. I won't take the time to repeat that. Glenn went into that in his session, but I think it'll answer a lot of your questions, and we hope that the film that we have today, Myrna will be talking to you a little bit about her story, and then we're going to go into this thing. We understand that many people don't agree with it, but I personally am convinced of it. I mean, I wasn't in agreement with it at first, but the more that I have studied in the last 20 years, the research that has gone on, I have become convinced that alcoholism is not a disease like cancer, but more like diabetes. More people can understand that one. Some people must not eat a lot of sugar because their bodies cannot handle it. And so it's a similar thing more to diabetes than it would be to something like a disease like cancer. So at this point, it's about a quarter till nine. I would like to introduce Myrna before we have the film so that she can share a little bit of her story with you. Okay.
Well, a few decades ago, before some of you were even born, I took a class called Epistles of Paul at Ambassador College. And, I'm really not older than dirt, but, you know. At any rate, I was taught that there were times that the Apostle Paul felt that it was necessary to give his credentials, that he had to give a defense of his position because he was not terribly popular in the Christian world in the beginning because he had killed them. So he would often have to defend his position in the early church. I want to give a little bit about my background and my credentials and where I am today. I've worked in the field of alcoholism for 9 years. I worked 5 years at a women's facility in Pasadena. I worked a year at a men's facility in Burbank. I've worked in the criminal justice system for the last 2.5 years. I have jail clearance, which means that I can enter the jails like on an attorney room privilege, not just as a visitor, in both Los Angeles and San Diego counties. I was one of the very first people to ever give clearance, they ever gave clearance to, from the Sheriff's Department in San Diego County. I've probably had, in my time, including owning my own facilities, probably 1,000 people, men and women, their paths cross mine. That does not include the numbers of people that I've encountered in the jail system, in the criminal justice system. My role in the criminal justice system has to be working with attorneys, judges, public defenders. If the person's primary and core issue is alcoholism and substance abuse, to give them the opportunity to enter treatment rather than further incarceration. And approximately, in just in one county alone, I'll tell you about Hennepin County, Minneapolis. I'm not talking about some huge metropolitan city like Chicago, Los Angeles, or New York. I'm talking Minneapolis. 90% of the people booked at any given point in time are under the influence. You know, and Denny talked about the incredible effects of substance use on crime. So that's why my journey took me to the criminal justice system. As Denny said, I've been working in the field. I know people. I've been able to meet people through my experience, and I can only believe that God opened the doors. You know, I've personally heard people from the Harvard Medical School of Medicine, from the Committee on Psychiatry with the American Medical Association. I've worked with personally one of the premier people in social model recovery in the nation. I've been able to go to drug and alcohol summits and hear people that I didn't know were so important when I went. I've heard football greats that talk about their recovery, and I've really been fortunate, the doors that God has opened to provide me with an education. And I've been able to share it with the world out there, society at large, and now I've been given the incredible opportunity to share it with a household of faith. You know, and I take that responsibility very seriously. As Denny said, I've attended church for 40 years. You know, and that's part of it. But as Paul Harvey would say, what's the rest of the story? What's the rest of the story? You know, I grew up in a wonderful home. They're not alcoholic. There's alcoholism in my family. I had wonderful parents. I started attending church when I was 9 years old. I think that God started working with me almost immediately, and I was not terribly thrilled with that. You know, I can't say I was one of those people that wanted to be called as a teenager. You know, I wanted to do the things that everybody else was doing, but that's not how my life was. I know the day, I know the time my calling was a dramatic thing. I was 15 years old after the Feast of Tabernacles in geometry class. It was through the power of prayer. If you want to hear about that, I'll tell you about it. I was baptized when I was 18 years old. And, you know, I had a total commitment, conviction, and courage, as Dr. Ward talks about, to this way of life. As I said, I came from this incredible family. My parents were everything to me. Everything. My sister's 9 years older, so we were raised as only children. And I had, you know, just an incredible relationship with my parents. And my father died when I was 19 years old. My mother died when I was 20 years old. And that was difficult. That was difficult. And I went on to marry someone that I had known a long time that's also a member of the Church of God and still is to this day. And we started down that path to the white picket fence, the 2.1 children, the station wagon, and the dog. But you know what? It didn't turn out that way. And by the time I was 25 years old, I'd lost three of the closest people that anybody can lose. My parents and I lost a child. You know, and what that did to me, it did nothing to change my faith in the plan of God, in His way of life, His ultimate power to do anything. I wasn't too sure about Him being a personal Savior in my life because I couldn't understand how these things could happen and why I needed to learn so much and build so much character, and that's what people were telling me. And I don't believe those things today, but that's where I was when I was 25 years old. As I said, I come from a background where there is a genetic tendency to alcoholism. I have first cousins on both sides of the family that are an alcoholic. I have uncles that have died of the disease of alcoholism. Alcoholism was not hidden in my family. We knew they were drunks. And, you know, I can remember it being said in my family, poor old so-and-so, he's such a nice guy when he's sober. No, and I didn't set out, and it is not what it said in my high school yearbook, that I plan on being an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Church of God. I was baptized. I took that commitment seriously. I'm married to a church member who works at headquarters. My sister is Denny's wife, a high-ranking minister in the Church of God, and I start drinking. And I deal with that guilt and that shame, and I take the Passover, and I think every single time it's going to be different now. I examined myself as thoroughly as I could. You know, my drinking career is very short. Denny explained to you that the effect of alcohol on women is greater. My decline was fast. And I thank God for that. I thank God for that. You know, I have two children. My eldest is 25. My youngest is 21. And they had a passed out falling down drunk for a mom. And I'm a member of the Church of God. And I'm praying and asking God, and I am crying, saying, why does this keep happening to me? Why do I do this? And today I know why, because I suffer from the disease of alcoholism, an allergy of the body, an obsession of the mind, and a spiritual void. And again, I thank God that He revealed that to me, that I have the disease of alcoholism. The reason we put this part now here today, with me sharing this with you, is because the idea that I have a disease, that I am not a bad person trying to get good, I'm a sick person trying to get well, may very well have saved my life. May very well have saved my life. I had loving, caring people in my life. I'm still married today, not because of my actions, because I am married to a man that is committed to God's way of life and practices forgiveness. And again, I'm extremely grateful to that. You know, he's learned a lot in the last 10 years, 8 months, and 8 days of my recovery. 11 years, 8 months, and 8 days. You know, and I never want to forget what it used to be like. Because by the grace of God and through a program of recovery, one day at a time, I've been given a reprieve. I am not cured, and I understand that. I will always be alcoholic. So I need to always be aware that I'm given a daily reprieve and thank God each day for that reprieve. And I've been given a spiritual path to maintain it. As I said, I used to cry and pray, why does this keep happening to me? And I'd get some periods of sobriety. You know, the longest that I ever had was 4 months. You know, and things immediately get better with physical sobriety. But it is not just a physical problem. It's mental, emotional, and spiritual. And I began through a program of recovery to be restored physically. And I was incredibly sick. You know, I'll tell you a little bit about the detox process for me, and because I have a few more minutes here. My skin peeled where the alcohol would evaporate out of my system. My hair was dry and brittle. I had wine sores on my face. I have no idea how much my liver was compromised. They didn't tell me. But I can tell you, in preparing for this class, and I read about the physical effects of alcohol, I can tell you I was extremely sick. I'm a little bit more prone to some diseases today, some illnesses, such as bronchitis, and I believe that that's because of the damage that I did to my body drinking. You know, I believe that God has forgiven me, but my body still has the effects. I have not been healed of the effects. I do believe that forgiveness is one of the most important things that I have been given. The forgiveness of a loving, caring God who sent Christ to be my personal Savior. If Christ had to die for no other reason, I know it was for Myrna Leisure. And I'm grateful for that. And you know, all that God was waiting for was me to say, I'm sorry, please help me. And I did that, but I didn't understand until I was given the tools of books like this and a path of recovery. You know, and I would get those periods of sobriety and I'd drink again, and one more time, I would be looking in the mirror going, what happened? And I had no clue. I didn't plan on it being that way. I never, ever set out to be a passed out, falling down drunk on any given day. This day it was going to be different. You see, all you people out there, you were controlling it and you could drink normally. I just knew if I tried harder, I could too. I didn't understand that once I took a drink, that allergy of the body was set off, and all that my body ever says is, you need more. Always. You know, I look at my sister and she has a half a glass of wine, I wonder what in the world's wrong with her. Her body doesn't send the same message to her that she needs more. I know now that I was prayed into the path of recovery by my family. And I was told once, when a few years ago, to thank the people that prayed me into recovery. And I did that. Denny and Leanne and my husband and my children. And I'm grateful that I have a relationship with those people today, because there are some of my family members that have chosen to keep it in the back of their mind, you know, she's alcoholic. And I can feel the fact that I have not been forgiven. All I can do today, by given the path that God has shown me, is to honor them, to treat them with love and tolerance, and as I believe my parents would have wanted them to be treated, to the best of my ability. Now, I cannot make someone forgive me. I believe that as I forgive, I am forgiven. I believe that as I judge, I am judged. I wanted very much to share this with you before we have a get-together tonight, to give you an opportunity to speak with me, should you choose to. It's a difficult thing, as I said. There's probably little I know that is as difficult as taking the Passover as an alcoholic and not understanding why. And today, the Passover is not like that for me. I believe in the plan of God. I believe in a personal salvation. I am grateful for the knowledge that I have of that plan today. I am grateful that you as a group are embracing the opportunity to learn about that plan of salvation and pass it on. I'm grateful I was given the opportunity to share that there is a solution. Tomorrow, that's what we're going to talk about. Why did I tell you that it was important for me to share it today? because of the disease concept. I do believe that God taught me that I have a disease in order to save my life today. And I believe because He taught me that, I have a responsibility to share it and carry it to other people. Again, I can't stress enough that it may very well have been the key factor in me being even being alive today. Because without that knowledge and without God's grace, I would be dead. I have a fatal disease. I think that's about it for now. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to share it with you, and I take it very seriously. Denny and I were talking about it earlier. You know, I'm a serious person, and I've endeavored to lighten up in life. And I've gotten a whole lot more flexible since I quit drinking. That's part of who I am and part of my challenge, part of my character defects and where I am today. But I'm moving forward through the knowledge of God's truth and a spiritual approach. So now I guess we're going to show the film.
Okay, thank you, Myrna.
The film we'll be seeing is by Dr. Max Schneider, who is the former chairman of the National Council of Alcoholism, a specialist in the area of alcohol and its effect upon the body. It's about 24 minutes. He's talking about abuse of alcohol. I don't know if you hear him say that word because he's given... This is part two of his other lecture, but he's talking here about heavy drinking and the misuse and abuse of alcohol. I don't know if he says it in this part of the lecture, but we do know, we went through that in the Bible, that alcohol in small amounts for the non-alcoholic is beneficial. But he's talking here about heavy drinking and what alcohol can do when abused and misused.
In our previous discussion, we covered the effects of alcohol on the various organ systems and tissues of the body. Alcohol is a leading cause of death and disability in the United States and throughout the world. And remember, it doesn't make any difference whether it's wine, whiskey, or beer. 12 ounces of beer has the same alcohol content as one shot of whiskey or 4 ounces of 12% wine. Now, let's discuss the effects of ethyl alcohol on the nervous system. The brain is made up of millions of nerve cells that communicate with each other and with nerve cells throughout the body. This is a typical nerve cell with its cell body filled with protein and multiple branches called dendrites on which there are neuroreceptors. The long shaft, like a torpedo tube, is called an axon. The axon contains multiple electrolytes, chemicals like sodium, potassium, chloride, calcium, and magnesium. These chemicals help transmit the electrical impulse through the nerve. At the end of the axon is the terminal where chemicals called neurotransmitters are stored and are sent to other nerves to activate them. Some of these neurotransmitters are epinephrine, norepinephrine, GABA, serotonin, dopamine, and dozens of others. It is these neurotransmitters that provide the communication from one nerve cell to another. The receptor cells are hungry, and they're sitting there saying, "Feed me, feed me." When we think, feel, or move, an electrical impulse going down the axon causes the neurotransmitters from the stimulated nerve to go to the receptor sites of other nerves, causing those nerves to be satiated and activated. Alcohol works on the brain cells in three ways. First, it attacks the membrane or covering of the nerve, and it makes that nerve go from a strong and stalwart cell into a very soft and porous nerve cell, leaking out the electrolytes like sodium, potassium, and magnesium. And this affects the conductivity of the impulses passing through this cell and will affect how we think and react. Secondly, alcohol acts like a neurotransmitter chemical. When you put a substance in your body that the body normally manufactures, it turns off the body's own production of that substance. Alcohol, acting like a neurotransmitter, turns off the body's own production of neurotransmitting chemicals. When the alcohol wears off and the brain production of neurotransmitters has been turned off, the receptors are sitting there saying, "Feed me, feed me," and the person becomes very uncomfortable. Hungry receptors create a feeling called craving or drug hunger. Other mood-altering drugs such as tranquilizers and sedatives and opiates like heroin, morphine, or codeine, and psychomotor stimulants like speed, nicotine, or cocaine have been shown to affect the neurotransmitting system of brain cells. Alcohol works on the nerve cells in a third way. I've got some bad news and some good news for you. The bad news is, as you're sitting here desperately trying to stay awake, the protein matrix of your brain cells is gradually breaking down. The good news is that at the same time, fresh new protein is being manufactured according to your own genetics. Now, this is a very slow process. Studies have shown that in the presence of alcohol, the reproduction of the new protein is altered and different from our own genetics. Instead of manufacturing a protein that is normal, we produce different kinds of brain substance. And this alters our thought processes to think, to remember, or function. There is evidence to show that cerebral atrophy, shrinking of the brain frequently seen in heavy drinkers, is due to this process. With this condition comes memory loss, mental dysfunctioning, and a disease called Korsakoff's psychosis. However, in the absence of alcohol, the process reverses. The abnormal brain cell protein breaks down and is gradually replaced by normal brain tissue according to one's genetics. Memory and mental functioning may return, and even the brain atrophy, the shrinking of the brain, may clear. This has been demonstrated on CAT scans. Remember, this is a very slow process taking many months and will continue as long as one stays away from alcohol. So, alcohol affects the brain cells biophysiologically. These conditions where alcohol affects the brain cells, I call chemical organic brain syndrome, or COBS. Chemical organic brain syndrome may be acute, subacute, or chronic. The acute phase is intoxication and will have significant chemical changes. The potassium and other chemicals will begin to leak out, the neurotransmitters will become altered, and the brain protein changes gradually begin. The subacute chemical organic brain syndrome follows the acute stage. After intoxication, when the alcohol level is coming down, changes in the brain remain. Withdrawal symptoms occur, and gradually brain tissue begins to return toward normal. This may take days to weeks. The third stage of COBS is the chronic chemical organic brain syndrome, where the changes I've described in the brain cell protein will require many months to return to normal. All during this time, the thinkability continues to improve. The drug alcohol is a sedative, a depressant. Alcohol doesn't stimulate nerves, it puts nerves to sleep. It's an anesthetic. You've cut your finger, and you decide to clean it with some alcohol. So you apply the alcohol on the cut, and it burns, right? 10 seconds later, the burning disappears, and you decide it needs more cleaning, so you put more alcohol on, and now it doesn't burn anymore. Well, what has happened? Alcohol has sedated the nerves and put them to sleep. Well, just as alcohol puts a single nerve to sleep, it puts the entire brain to sleep. I like to compare our brain structure to the structure of an onion. Now, this is not anatomically correct. It is diagrammatic. Within the brain, as in the onion, there is a core and many layers. The deepest part, like the core of an onion, is the thing that keeps us alive, our hearts beating, our lungs functioning. And then there are multiple layers with increasing function. And I'll just mention a few. First, there may be reflexes, and then motion and sensation, and then some coordination of the ability to move towards warmth or comfort and away from cold. And there's the reaction skills. And finally, there are those layers which separate humans from the lower animals, these layers are judgment and inhibition. When we use an anesthetic to put someone to sleep, we sedate the brain slowly, taking the person down through the different layers of the brain from the most recently developed part to the deepest core. Well, getting drunk is the same process. Like any anesthetic, alcohol affects the most recently developed brain layers, the most sensitive ones first. And so the first to go are inhibitions and judgment, reaction skills down to unconsciousness, and finally, death itself. The process of intoxication, acute organic brain syndrome, changes the way in which we perceive stimuli, the world around us, people, places, and things. And then how we think about those stimuli, and finally, how we react to those perceptions. The following blood levels are approximations and will, of course, vary from person to person. At 0.02, our judgment and inhibitions are affected. At 0.05, our reaction time is impaired and driving a car becomes dangerous. 0.08 affects our vision, speech, and balance. And at 0.15, a person's muscle control is affected and walking ability is diminished. As the blood alcohol level goes above 0.20, sensory loss is experienced. Blackouts may occur, and loss of consciousness, coma, and eventually death follow. Acute COBS alters our thinking and behavior, and this affects our relationships with our family and friends, our job, and with ourselves, our self-esteem. These changes in brain function cause mood swings and depression, which may mimic or imitate every kind of psychiatric disorder. With impaired judgment and inhibitions, the incidence of accidents and crime rise. And throughout all these changes, we often don't see ourselves the way we really are. In fact, we often deny that we are different or impaired at all. Many police officers describe the experiences they've had where they've stopped obviously intoxicated motorists who didn't believe they were impaired. "What do you mean, officer, I'm too drunk to drive? I certainly am not." This is a form of denial. It is not that we will not see ourselves the way we are. It is that we cannot see ourselves the way we are because alcohol has put our judgment and our inhibitions to sleep. There's another form of denial. It's very difficult and painful for some people to really believe that they are unable to handle alcohol. They believe it is a sign of weakness. Their ego is hurt. It's not manly or macho or sophisticated. And so they deny, and the disease of chemical dependence progresses. Acute COBS will also cause short-term memory loss because one's attention is sedated. Blackout, a total loss of memory for events lasting for a few moments to several days, may occur during this stage. This is like typing on a typewriter with no paper in it to record the message. The second phase of COBS is the subacute. As soon as alcohol or any other drug enters our body, our organs begin the process of detoxification, breaking down and getting rid of the drug. 5% of alcohol goes through our lungs and kidneys, and 95% is removed by the liver. Our liver can detoxify about a half an ounce of absolute alcohol or one standard drink per hour. And as our alcohol level drops, its sedative effects continue for a period of time. Now, one of the things that I learned as a child from my parents is that we never get anything for nothing. For everything we get, we must pay a price. People are not made to be calm all the time. If you wanted to be calm and quiet all the time, you made the first mistake by being a human being. You should have been born a rock, because as far as I know, it's only rocks that stay calm all the time. Humans are growing, changing animals. Now, if I decide I want to take a downer, for instance, I'm going to have a shot of booze, a can of beer, or a glass of wine. I drink it, and in about 40 minutes, it's in my bloodstream. And at the end of an hour, it's having its maximum effect on my brain. After about 4 hours, the sedative effects on my brain are worn off, and tranquilization is complete. Now, we never get anything for nothing. And so a downer drug, whether it's tranquilizers or alcohol or sleeping medication, as it is wearing off from the brain, there is a withdrawal or agitation effect, which is not as strong in intensity as the sedation, but it lasts longer. Now, after one or two drinks, the agitation phase of withdrawal is hardly noticeable. But as the alcohol intake increases, so does the severity and longevity of the withdrawal phase. Therefore, after a period of time, we find that the sedation effect has worn off and the stimulation effect now takes over. We become nervous, agitated, and we require more sedative to overcome this withdrawal effect. I frequently see patients who complain of sleeping problems, and I ask them, do you have trouble getting to sleep or staying to sleep? And they say, oh no, doc, I get to sleep fine, but I wake up in 4 or 5 hours and I just can't get back to sleep. And I ask myself, what are they taking to sedate themselves that puts them to sleep, but wears off in 4 or 5 hours and creates a withdrawal agitation? And it's usually alcohol. Now it works the other way too. If we take an upper drug such as speed or cocaine or even caffeine, we start with the agitation effect, but when that wears off, we crash. This withdrawal is less in intensity, but again, it is longer in duration than the stimulation effect of the drug. And so you can see, if you take a downer drug, you're going to pay for it with agitation, and if you take an upper drug, you're going to pay for it with depression. We get nothing for nothing. The effects of alcohol withdrawal can be simple, you know, anxiety, restlessness, insomnia, a hangover, or the subacute COBS can be protracted and severe. Withdrawal can create so much agitation that the body shakes and may even have a grand mal epileptic-like seizure. These seizures are extremely dangerous and may create more brain damage as well as fractures, vomiting, aspiration, and death. And delirium tremens, the so-called DTs, is a serious consequence of the withdrawal process from alcohol. And so we see, the alcohol may be detoxified from the system, but its effects last much longer. If I hit my thumb with a hammer and I throw the hammer away, my thumb hammer level is zero, but the malady lingers on. Now, the third phase of chemical organic brain syndrome is the chronic stage, and it begins 1 to 3 months after quitting drinking. It is more intense during the first 2 years and continues more subtly indefinitely. During the first 6 months of this stage, the supply of neurotransmitters is gradually replenished. Drug craving, drug hunger diminishes. Exercise, good nutrition, and meditation enhance this process. The senses of smell and taste return, and appetite improves. Blood sugar levels stabilize. Control over inhibition and judgment improves, and relationships become more appropriate. Studies have shown that the cognitive abilities continue to improve over a period of many years. Issues involving the people, places, and things in one's life, sexuality, grief, guilt, shame, family of origin, and codependency and resocialization are dealt with in this stage of COBS. There's continued improvement in how we feel, think, relate, and act over the years. Now, I'd like to talk about the effects of the alcohol on the blood sugar system and how this affects the brain. If we measure blood sugar from a healthy, normal person who has had nothing to eat or drink for approximately 8 hours, we would find that that blood sugar level would be at approximately 60 to 80 milligrams per cent. And if at this point we give this person 100 grams of sugar, the blood sugar would rise in about 1 hour to approximately 170 milligrams per cent. And at the end of 2 hours, it would be down to about normal. We call this the normal glucose or sugar tolerance curve. The body's ability to handle and take sugar out of the bloodstream and deposit it in muscle, the liver, and brain for energy. Now, if we give a person who has sugar diabetes, diabetes mellitus, the same amount of sugar, the blood level of sugar would go well over 200. and then at the end of 2 hours would not be back to normal, in fact, may never come back to the fasting stage, depending upon how severe the diabetes is. We call this the diabetic glucose tolerance curve. Now, if we have a person who does not have diabetes, but who has liver disease, including alcohol liver disease, and give that person 100 grams of sugar, this level may well go way up over 200, and at the end of 2 hours, it comes back down below the fasting level, and then we have a condition called hypoglycemia, or low blood sugar. Now, the brain requires a certain amount of sugar to function properly. And when a person's blood sugar level is at this low level, there's not enough sugar to feed the brain. And that person becomes nervous and shaky and doesn't think clearly. If used to taking alcohol when emotionally uncomfortable, that person may well take a fix of alcohol to get comfortable. Hypoglycemia is not a cause of alcoholism, but it may be a cause of relapse. Now, let me say a word about the combined effects of drugs. It is well known that one downer drug, taken at the same time that another downer drug is ingested, results in an addition of their effects. But in many cases, this effect is multiplied, and the drug combination is even more potent. In this case, 1 + 1 may equal 3 or 5. In other words, if a person takes a drink and then takes a sleeping pill, the combined effect may be much stronger than the simple addition of the two effects. This is called a synergistic effect. The combination of chemicals creates a very dangerous situation, depressing respiration, heart action, and frequently causing death. Under the influence of alcohol or other mind-altering drugs, one may not remember having taken one's medicine and take an extra dose and thus overdose. With frequent use of mood-altering drugs, some brain and liver adaptation or getting used to the drug may occur, requiring more and more of the drug to have the same effect. We call this tolerance. This is a danger sign that chemical dependence may be forming. Look at Jane. Boy, can she drink and not show it. Look at Sam. He can really put it away. And that scares me because Jane and Sam have developed tolerance and they are becoming addicted. Now, some people are hypersensitive to certain drugs. If a person came into my office with pneumonia and had a history of hypersensitivity to penicillin, even though I knew that penicillin would cure the pneumonia, I would not dare administer it because I might kill the person while trying to cure the pneumonia. So it is with alcohol. Some people inherit a hypersensitivity to alcohol while other people develop it. And no matter how good the intent, that is, just relax, feel better. Once they have developed this hypersensitivity to alcohol, there is nothing that can change it. I have patients who say, "Doc, what's wrong with my willpower?" My answer is that there's nothing wrong with your willpower. It is purely chemical. The thing that says to you, "I'm going to take just one or two drinks," is your judgment, your inhibitions. And what is the first thing that is put to sleep by alcohol? It's your judgment and your inhibitions. If a person has developed hypersensitivity to alcohol so that the judgment is more quickly put to sleep by one or two or three drinks, then he or she must recognize this sensitivity just as the doctor must recognize hypersensitivity to penicillin or any other drug. The willpower comes with the recognition and acceptance of the facts as they are. Do you or do you not have a hypersensitivity to a drug? If you do and choose to ignore it, then this is a matter of denial. One must realize that this disease of hypersensitivity is a progressive disease. It never gets better, but always gets worse. You can't lose it. Once hypersensitive, always hypersensitive. And you may go 20 years without a drink and finally say, "Well, let's try it again. One won't hurt." And history will repeat itself. Everything we do in life is directed towards the goal of keeping ourselves physically and emotionally and psychologically comfortable. When we have an emotional or physical pain, we try to rid ourselves of this discomfort by either avoiding the painful stimulus, solving the painful problem, or ignoring it altogether. And if we come upon a substance which will help relieve the distress, we tend to follow the line of least resistance and take this substance just to relax, Doc. There's no harm in that. And so it goes, this technique of avoidance, this method of finding comfort. It becomes a psychological as well as a chemical dependence. Well, these then are some of the medical aspects of alcohol on the nervous system. As we have seen, alcohol is a powerful mind-altering drug. Its effects linger on, and denial keeps us from seeing that alcohol causes life problems. We need to recognize where we fit in this picture of chemical use. Are we using booze as a tranquilizer? If so, it's a lousy and dangerous choice of drug. Are we using it to avoid facing responsibilities or solving problems? Are we using it to gain social acceptance? The answer to these questions need to be made in the light of what we now know about the medical aspects of alcohol.